You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. My name's Maga, and on the other end is my very good friend and co-author, Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine. Spring seems to be coming. There's actual sun out there, even though it was snowing just last night. And hey, lots of good films either running at the moment or coming up. Lots of good TV. Way too many books to count. So yeah, good times.
Very good times, yeah. Although the sun, it's sort of deceptive. You know, it looks sunny, but it's very, very cold. So it's good to hide in a library or in a movie theater.
Or in front of the TV watching some Netflix.
True that, yes. Have you seen anything good lately? Tell us.
Absolutely, absolutely. Last night we went to see Call Me By Your Name and I really, really, really liked it.
Mm.
I haven't seen anything else by the director yet. He did A Bigger Splash, right?
He did, yes.
Exactly. And a film, I think, called I Am Love that I haven't been aware of that one. I should definitely check it out as well as A Bigger Splash. I thought Call Me By Your Name was... just, there's basically nothing I would criticize about it. I think the acting is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's very well directed. It's got its very own tone, atmosphere, personality. You know, I think it's one of those films where if you don't know about it, you've just read a, I don't know, 3-sentence summary, you might think, oh, okay, you know, gay romance, you know, politically correct, Hollywood liberal, la-di-da-di-da. And if you watch a film, you realize... if you describe it in such a facile way, you would not do any justice to it. I think the characters, they come to life so much. They're not streamlined, the characters. They're not made, you know, too nice.
Mm-hmm.
They just feel very, very real. And I was actually really surprised by Armie Hammer because I think I've only really seen him in The Social Network where I thought he was very good twice. Yeah. But it was a pretty one-dimensional part. It was mainly a part that was funny, that was amusing, but it was definitely not one of the more complex parts in The Social Network. And in this one, I think he does a great job with a really difficult part. But what's the younger guy called? Timothée, I can't pronounce it.
Chalamet, probably.
That's it, Timothée Chalamet. He is just fantastic in that one. I mean... Mm-hmm. Playing a teenager who's basically, I mean, playing teenagers well is difficult enough as it is because teenagers are notoriously not in control of themselves and their emotions. As an actor, you have to be in control of what you play. So playing someone who's not quite entirely in control, struggles to be in control, pretends to be in control, but is actually swept away by his feelings for this man and for having feelings for a man probably for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual feelings, romantic feelings, all of that is just handled so brilliantly by him.
Yeah, true. It stopped to be a gay romance very early on. I mean, I know it's still a gay romance, but it started to be about two quite different people in love who are curious about each other, but don't quite like each other at the beginning. And that made it all the more interesting. I rooted for them. I wanted to know what would happen next. Gay was one aspect, but by no means was it any kind of...
movie of the week, exactly.
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, it's also, it doesn't feel, you know, sometimes you get the impression with films that make a political point, you get the impression that they're trying to be representative of all gay people, all black people, all women, all whatever. And that's... rarely if ever works. In this one, I think the characters are just so specific that, I mean, you think of it just of these two characters, they don't say anything larger about, I don't know, young men discovering their homosexuality or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The film talks about these characters and it does so beautifully.
True, yeah. It's also, you forget that I think the movie is set in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two or three very short moments where Armie Hammer lets Timothy, or I forget the character's name, lets the young guy know what would be at stake if they came out, if their romance would be public. But that's it. There's not much politics in there. There's not much. There's not much of the usual problems of homosexual in the 1980s in there. It's just a love story. It's lush. It's secretive. There are also girls or young women involved. Warm summer nights, whatever. It sounds like a romance without the problematic aspect, and yet it's somehow in there. You can feel that it's, you can feel in an offhand manner that it's the 1980s or maybe even the early 1990s.
And I mean, it's Italy, it's rural Italy, it would probably be a problem, but I agree, it's good that the film isn't about that, because there's enough, well, I'm not sure there's enough films about that, but I think it's not political, and that in a way is a political statement. You know, it basically says you can have a gay romance that isn't about homosexuality, capital H, but that is about the characters. And I think that is also very, very important.
Yes. I was not too happy with the ending of A Bigger Splash. I liked I Am Love for many different reasons. There's also an illicit romance in there somewhere. And now, Call Me By Your Name, I think the director really knows what he's doing in there. He doesn't put one foot wrong. It's fantastic. It's something I didn't expect it to be that good, but it really is. Of course, I have to go and see Lady Bird now, because I think Chalamet is in there as well.
Yeah, exactly, he is. I think we saw the trailer for Lady Bird about four times over the last 4 weeks, and at a certain point, you kind of discover an inner backlash going on almost. But yeah, no, I'm definitely also curious about that one. I'm also curious about what Chalamet will do in that one, but at the same time, this part was just so well written, so well conceived, and so central to the film. I'm almost a bit afraid that whatever he does next, it's going to be a bit of a disappointment.
Chalamet, you mean?
Yeah, because I almost don't see how he can do something now that will live up to this. I think everything that comes now will kind of feel like, yeah, it's good, but it's not Call Me By Your Name.
It's possible. Yeah, I really hope he doesn't get swallowed up by some kind of, I don't know, TV series or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Or, you know, he could become the next Marvel superhero.
Yeah, well, I think what's going to save him is he speaks about three or four languages, so much so that you don't realize that he, you don't really know what his native language is, because he speaks them all so well. I mean, he changes in Call Me By Your Name, he changes between languages like drop of a hat, I think.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, that's one aspect of another thing. I don't think I've often seen films that felt so cosmopolitan, perhaps. I'm not sure whether that's the right word. There's or European. I mean, you've got American characters. You've got characters who are very much Italian, French, something.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is also in the filmmaking. I think very often, if you watch an American film, you, even if you switch off the sound, even if it's not set in America, you know it's an American film. There's a certain look to it. There's a certain rhythm to it. Same with, I don't know, German movies, French movies, English movies. This film, I wouldn't be able to pinpoint in that respect. It very much feels like its own thing. Mm-hmm. It's, again, very, very specific and not very much not derivative, I think.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yes.
No, I was really, really, really taken with it.
Yeah.
In general, I mean, I was thinking again, we talked about the Oscars, I think, last time or the time before that.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm usually not that interested in the Oscars, I think it has to be said that the Oscars that were just recently were a very good indication that 2017 was a fantastic year for movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was it, I forget, what was it nominated for? Was it nominated for anything? Best foreign movie? Or
I think it was actually nominated for best film. It should have been. Right. I absolutely think it should have been. If it hasn't, it wasn't. Screenplay, I think it might even have gotten that one. I think it's an adaptation of a novel. I'm pretty sure that Chalamet was nominated. I'd rather not look up the details because I don't want to be disappointed.
All right.
But yeah, I mean, I also liked The Shape of Water, which did get the Oscar for Best Film, but yep. I would say The Shape of Water is a sweet movie, it's a good movie, but compared to Call Me By Your Name, it's definitely the lesser movie.
All right.
Not because of theme or anything, but just because of everything, basically. And it's not, you know, it's not that I'm kind of, that I've got any kind of problems with fishmen. You know, some of my best friends are fishmen, but...
You're the fishman's friend.
Exactly. But in this case, I would definitely take, you know, Sexual Adventures with Peaches over fishmen.
Very good, yes.
What about you? Have you seen or read or listened to anything lately that really caught your attention?
I am almost through with Jessica Jones season 2.
Okay.
It's very much not as good as season 1. Oh. It takes about 3 or 4 episodes or even 5 episodes to sort of find its footing. It's I sort of accept that it has to clean up after The Defenders. I haven't seen The Defenders. I don't know what's going on. But 4 or 5 episodes is sort of too long to find its footing again.
Mm-hmm. I think it's... I mean, it's one thing that I would say is true for all of these Netflix Marvel series. They could be cut by a third or even half, and they would improve in the process.
Yes. It gets better as soon as Janet McTeer shows up in the series. Mm-hmm. Here's a mild spoiler. She turns out to be Aliza Jones, Jessica Jones's mother. She also got operated on because the whole Jones family was involved in the car accident. They all got operated on. Only Mom and Jessica survived. And now Jessica has to come to terms that her mother has a very short fuse. She gets very violent if prompted the wrong way. Mm-hmm. She's a kind of miniature Hulk, if you like. She has anger management problems, breathtaking mm-hmm. ones. And I don't know what happens at the very end. I yet have to watch the last 2 episodes. Jessica gets so concerned for her mother that she has a certain violent episode by herself, caused by her mother. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, opens her mental state for Kilgrave again.
Okay, yeah.
That's all I'm going to say. It's sort of a problem of a second season if you have to sort of reanimate the baddie from season 1 who mm-hmm. who does not exist anymore in order to be good again. Janet McTeer does what she can with the role, but she can't save season 2 quality-wise. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say.
So would you say it's just not as good, or would you say it's actively going into bad territory?
I'm not going to watch it a second time. Once I'm through with it, I'm through with it. If there's going to be a season 3, yeah, I'm going to be there. But season 2 is sort of a... It has taken a dive, and they would have to think very cleverly about the content of season 3 to sort of up the ante again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame. I mean,
it is.
I think there's potential in all of these Netflix Marvel series, but I think worse than the movies, they have certain issues that have been there from the beginning, from Daredevil season 1, and they haven't addressed them. Mm-hmm. If anything, they've gotten worse. I think pacing is one of them. Length, definitely in connection with pacing. It's just all of them have too much time and not enough story.
Yeah.
And it affects everything else. The characters get more boring. You're treading water. And I think if the audience feels you're treading water, you're doing something very, very wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not a guy who sort of checks his phone while watching a series or doing something else. When I watch a series, I watch a series. But mm-hmm. during certain early episodes of Jessica Jones season 2, I found myself thinking, I think I should paint the wall in our living room, you know. That's usually a bad sign.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, shame.
Yes. Let's talk about, brighter pastures.
Okay.
You've brought us something today.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought that it would be great if we could talk about some cerebral, mysterious, curiosity-driven science fiction, mm-hmm. namely Thor Ragnarok.
Excuse me?
Okay. No, it's actually not Thor Ragnarok. I think what I really would like to talk about is Annihilation. Since we were already mm-hmm. with Netflix, Alex Garland's Annihilation, which was released, I think, at cinemas in America. I'm not sure whether it got a wide release, but mm-hmm. in Europe, at least, and I think in most of the world, we got it a couple of weeks later on Netflix. We're not getting it at the cinema, which is, you know, one of those good news, bad news things. I think it's mm-hmm. great that more people get a chance to see it. I think it's really not good that so few people get a chance to see it at the cinema, because it's absolutely a film mm-hmm. that should be seen on a big screen. It's a film whose atmosphere, I think, the bigger the screen, the more you get sucked into the atmosphere. And I think it's one of those films that very much relies on mood, on tone, on atmosphere. You've mm-hmm. also seen it, right? What did you think of it?
I've seen it, yes. I also read the book before I watched it. And the book is, I think it's a trilogy. Mm-hmm. I only read the first one, which sort of was turned into the movie. Annihilation is, for someone who's sort of skeptical towards sci-fi and also fantasy, it's a very, very good deal. I like the book, but I like the movie much more. Mm-hmm. The novel is by a guy called Jeff Vandermeer, whom I didn't know before reading the book. It is mostly not very keen on plot. Mm-hmm. It just tells the story of four women going to a certain kind of place. The women in the book are not even named. They're named after their occupation. The biologist, the surveyor, the physicist, and the psychologist, mm-hmm. I think. I liked the book, but it takes place after certain events, and it always has those backflashes, and that's also true for the movie. Mm-hmm. I think the movie steps up the game a little bit. It features other things that are not in the novel. Maybe it's in the second part of the novel. I don't know. The movie is very atmospheric. It doesn't rely on its CGI, although the CGI is masterfully done, mm-hmm. I thought.
I mean, it's especially, I think, the design work behind it is very, very good. It's mm-hmm. in that kind of uncanny midpoint between beautiful and horrific. It's definitely the imagery itself is already quite haunting. I agree with you. I think it's a very well-made film. I also think, I haven't read the book yet. It's on one of my heaps of books to read. I got it for Christmas, and I definitely want to read it very soon, at least the first one, and see what that one's like. You mentioned that the characters don't even have names in the book, and I think you feel that the film is also not entirely interested in its characters. It is interested enough, I think, for the purpose of the film, but mm-hmm. I think they remain a bit sketchy. And I think what characters are there is mainly done by the actors or the actresses, and they do a very good job there. But I have to say that Alex Garland, over the last couple of years, has become one of the writer-directors where, if I hear his name, I'm definitely going to look up and see what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He's done some, I think, very good, if flawed, work with Danny Boyle. They did The Beach together. I haven't seen or read that one, so I can't say anything about it. But 28 Days and Sunshine, both of them have deep flaws, especially the last act. I think Alex Garland in general, he sometimes has this tendency to, you know, the last act is basically where someone goes mad, people get killed, la-di-da. And that's totally the case in 28 Days Later and Sunshine, where I think the films suffer for that. But when they work, I think the mix of an interesting situation, a premise that is compelling, smart writing, characters that are developed enough to be interesting, but not overdeveloped, so the film doesn't become too kind of weighed down by individual characters. It's basically the interaction between characters and situation he does really well. Even in his adaptations, for instance, he did the he wrote the screenplay for Never Let Me Go, the Ishiguro adaptation, and I actually think that Never Let Me Go fits in quite well with something like Annihilation. I think one theme that he does again and again is dissolution, the dissolution of individuals, of personalities, characters that realize they have to change or they are forced to change. And that change might actually be death. That change might be something else. They're losing parts of themselves, literally, in Never Let Me Go. And it's basically, they're always kind of torn between holding on to who they were and letting go and becoming who they're going to become, which, as I said, might be, you know, dead. It's basically this fear of this moment between the person you were and the person you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you can no longer be who you were. Society is no longer what it was. Sunshine, the same thing. Never Let Me Go. Not so sure about Dread. I think Dread, while I liked it, it's a fun action film. It feels a bit like an odd one out. But then, of course, you've got Ex Machina, and I think that's where a lot of people, whether science fiction fans or not, looked up and said, hey, this guy could be really good.
Yeah, I see what you mean. He is interesting to me in that he does not make his points with a huge neon arrow and a big felt pen, you know. Especially in Annihilation, he does not tell you what exactly is going on. There are hints, there are many hints throughout the movie, and then suddenly you realize, really? All right, let's look out for this or that, and then you suddenly realize, yeah, that might be true. So he is not interested in giving someone lines that say, you know what's going on? It's this or that and the other, you know, or X's got crossed with our Y's, and now we are Z. He puts it to you, and then you realize it or you don't. And it's how you eventually get what he wants to get across is very well done. I mean, also in Never Let Me Go, he never spells out exactly what the hell is going on.
Till very late in the film, yeah.
Till very late, yeah.
You've also read his novel Coma, right?
Yeah, I think you gave that one to me once, yes.
Because
yeah.
I can imagine that that's one that many of our listeners who are mostly into his films or his adaptations might not know. It's basically about a guy in a coma, and it's very much internal drama, internal monologue. I'm not going to say too much about it, but I think anyone who liked Annihilation or Never Let Me Go or just likes, you know, what Garland generally does, should definitely check out Coma. Again, I think this sense of dissolution of a person, an individual, falling apart and trying to hold on is very much at the center of Coma. It's a fast read. It's a relatively short novel. It's basically almost a novella. Well worth checking out. But yeah, I think I'm curious what else he does, because I think he also needs to branch out a bit, perhaps. I think that he has a tendency to do similar things and do similar things well. But in that respect, it's probably good that he did Red, because that one thematically feels very different. And you get the impression, yes, he's an intellectual sci-fi writer, but he's also a bit of a geek. And I think that's actually fun to see.
Yeah.
I mean, he's worked on a number of video game scripts. Definitely appeal more to the geeky side of things, but also there, I mean, Enslaved is very much a post-apocalyptic story about society and individuals going to pieces and becoming something new, something surprising perhaps. I have to say that what I was not quite so prepared for was just how much Annihilation felt like Tarkovsky remixed. There's definitely the kind of stalker similarity, you know, both in Stalker and Annihilation, you've got this journey into a zone where strange things have happened and are still happening, a place that is deadly, but the true danger might actually not be in outside things, but in what the zones do to you. Of course, there's also mutant bears who basically bite off your face. That's also dangerous. But there's the more emotional, psychological danger, or philosophical danger, perhaps. I mean, I've been thinking about, is Annihilation a thinking man's sci-fi movie? Is it intellectual? And I think it's mostly philosophical. It raises certain issues, but I would agree with you, it does not provide any answers. And it's not a film where you can think your way to a full, perfect, neat interpretation of this is what has happened, this is what is happening, and this is what it means. But to get back to Tarkovsky, as I said, Stalker, there's definitely a connection there. But also Solaris, you remember either version of Solaris, whether you're talking about the novel or the original Tarkovsky, or even the remake by Steven Soderbergh, where you've got a spouse who's dead, possibly dead or missing, returning, but whoever comes back is not the same as the person who is gone. They're an imperfect copy. There's a question of, are they real? What about my feelings for the person they were? What about my feelings for the person they now are? To what extent does the other person become someone else because of your feelings? And what does that do to you? So I think, you know, basically, Annihilation, the premise is all about, you know, DNA mixing, blending, refracting. And I think the DNA of Tarkovsky is definitely within Annihilation.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I would agree, yeah. It's probably that Annihilation has some kind of wider delta of possibilities that you could latch on. You know, you have to sort of keep your options open about what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm.
In Stalker, there are only a few options, and you realize Stalker is heading towards something. It's by no means a one-track movie, but it's going towards some place or some state or some point in time where a lot of things that are unclear will be sort of decided or nailed to the wall, if you like. Annihilation has more options. It's much more open. You don't know what happened. You don't know what's going to happen. Where are we right now and right here? are we being watched? If we are being watched, by whom and why? Where are all the other people? Why are there abandoned villages, abandoned lighthouses? What's going on? The explanation in Annihilation it's almost a given that the explanation is slightly more complicated than it is in Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
At least on the surface.
I'm not sure I would agree with you there. I think to some extent, you know, the premise of Annihilation, I do think is relatively simple, you know. Meteorite comes from space, crashes into lighthouse, weird shimmer emerges from it. The area around it is evacuated. The shimmer keeps increasing and weird things happen within the shimmer. I think what the shimmer is, what it does and what that means, that is open, yes. But I think other than that, I do think it spells out things more than Stalker does, at least in the premise. But in terms of what happens in the shimmer, what it does with the land, with the people, with the animals, and with the characters that the film has, that is ambiguous, I agree. I looked up a couple of reviews, and there was one that didn't like the film so much, but the one thing it says I think is worth talking about, even though I like the film better. It's Christopher Orr from The Atlantic, and what he wrote, I made a note of this yesterday, I kind of did my homework, I wrote down this, you know, quote and everything. So what he says is, Annihilation is so resolutely vague, so eager to confound, that its ambiguity becomes itself ambiguous. Does it intend to let viewers balance competing interpretations? Or does it simply not know what it is trying to say? And at first I thought, that's unfair. But the more I think about it, I do think he's onto something to some extent. I have to say that I liked Annihilation a lot, but I mainly liked it for the journey, not for the destination.
Mm-hmm.
I think also it's one of those films where you've got, what is it, five main characters, and one by one, they fall by the wayside for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you're left with one person. I think I like it better while there's more than one person. Because when, in the end, basically when it's just Natalie Portman, she's a great kind of projection pane, but there's also something a bit empty to the character. And empty by design, you know, she's, you don't quite know what's going on with her. You don't quite know where she's coming from with what she's doing and why she's doing it. But I think that's where I would agree with this, Christopher Orr. The film is happy to give you the questions. The film doesn't have to give us answers. I don't think it needs to give us answers, but I don't think Garland or Vandermeer have much in the way of answers in their minds. You know, in that respect, it reminds me a bit of something like Lost when it got really bad. You know, you give people a big, big question mark that's dressed up with good-looking actors and interesting CGI, and you say, there you go, question mark. You asked for it, you have it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the film, do you think that you can come to any conclusions that must, that might still be ambiguous, but that are still conclusive? Or do you think that the ending is completely open?
No, I don't think the ending is completely open. By the end of the movie, we have a good idea what is going on the genetic level, let's say. But it's sort of unfair to think about that because I haven't read books 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Vandermeer is able to sort of wrap most things up, not many loose ends and everything. Maybe Garland flirts with the idea of making his own movie trilogy, you know?
Yeah, I think I actually read something where he said that no one film and he's done with it. He doesn't see it as part one of a larger thing. He sees it as its own concluded thing.
That settles it then.
Yeah.
Some answers are there. Some answers only exist because I've found some kind of concept to make sense of the movie. Some answers are in the movie, some answers are just mine, and there are open questions that I just can't answer because the movie doesn't answer them, or I don't have the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Ambiguity becomes itself ambiguous. Yes, well, that's slightly too theoretical right now. I would have to think about that. I'm not sure even I know what it means. I was intrigued while it was on screen.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about it a lot afterwards. I still think about it, but I don't think about Annihilation in terms of, oh well, that was much too ambiguous, or the other way around, it answered all of its questions. Neither statement would be true.
Mm-hmm.
And no one would claim that that's the case. It answers some of the questions, yes. It is, in a way, much more in its moment than it has a fixed overall concept of what it wants to do. Imagine, for instance, the Tessa Thompson character.
Mm-hmm.
She says something profound, wanders off screen, Natalie Portman tries to follow her, and Tessa Thompson's gone. End of story.
Mm-hmm. Well, is she gone or is she transformed?
I don't know. Do you know?
Well, let's put it like that. There, I don't feel that I, you know, there are parts of the film, especially the ending, more or less, where I feel, you know, the film veers a bit too much into, you know, you drink some red wine, you smoke some dope, and you say, whoa, this is deep. There is a tendency towards that. It's not as bad as it is with certain other films, but it's there. With the Tessa Thompson character's last scene, I think, there I wouldn't say it's there, because the exact mechanics of what happened to her are not important. What is important is, in a way, the decision that she makes. I mean, basically, and I mean, we've probably already spoiled some things here. We're going to spoil a bit more by just becoming more concrete. In this Area X, people blend with the things that are there. They blend with each other. DNAs merge. Plant DNA, human DNA, animal DNA, mineral, vegetable, basically. And they all become something other than what they were. They become perhaps less human. They become something that is perhaps not recognizable, something that is perhaps alien. And one of the characters basically goes there because she's dying from cancer, and she thinks perhaps if her DNA is remixed, if she is refracted, perhaps that will heal her, perhaps that will save her. Another character goes there because her husband went there and something came back, but that something is perhaps not her husband. Can she save him? Mm-hmm. Who knows? Tessa Thompson's character, she says something along the lines, I think, you know, this other character wants to face it. You want to fight it. I don't want either of these things, which is mm-hmm. ambiguous. But then you see she basically, she accepts that the person she was is not going to exist anymore. She accepts that this is going to change her. There's a certain fatalistic, almost zen thing about it. But she basically says, she doesn't say it out loud, but her actions say, I accept that this place changes me fundamentally. And mm-hmm. that is okay. Which I think, you know, for me fits in very well with the characters in, for instance, Never Let Me Go. You've got some that fight against their fate in Never Let Me Go. Again, we're going to spoil everything now. We're going to tell you what happens to Dumbledore and so on. In Never Let Me Go, the characters are basically clones bred as, you know, to have their organs harvested for the originals. They get a relatively good life, but their days are numbered from the beginning. At some point, they're going to have a kidney removed, then perhaps a bit of liver. And at some point, they simply cannot survive. So they are basically designed to fall apart. No one tells them that until very late in the film. They don't know it, but they know that they are doomed somehow. And you can fight against the dying of the light, or you can accept that, or anything in between. The Tessa Thompson character is very much the one who says, I am already gone. Fighting against it will not do anything about it. It might just prolong the agony. I'm going to accept my fate and embrace it. And that to me is concrete enough to some extent. It's about, you know, how do people deal with these kind of situations? It's, yes, in this case, it's a weird, surreal, frightening alien invasion type thing. But the general thing, the general, I don't know, psychological or philosophical state she's in is one that I find quite relatable. Whereas, to spoil some more, with Natalie Portman's character at the very end, she destroys whatever this is, this alien incursion. But when she comes out of the shimmer and she comes back to her husband, who isn't really her husband, who is an alien copy of her husband to some extent, it's clear that the shimmer is still inside her. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Is there anything of her left? Is she a copy? We don't know. But the thing is also the character is done in a way that is purposefully blank. And that doesn't give me anything to hold on to. In that respect, you know, thinking back to Solaris, where you've got the main character's dead spouse who killed herself being recreated by the planet as a copy mm-hmm. made from the emotions and memories of the main character. You've got this copy who has a life of her own. But she also knows she's just a version. She's just a copy. She's just what the other guy remembers. She's incomplete. And I can relate to that, even though I myself am not an alien clone copy of someone. But with Natalie Portman's character, there's just blank. We don't know what she... I mean, we don't need to know what she thinks. We don't need to know what she feels. But I get the impression that we're not even given an indication. I actually think we have more of an indication with the version of her husband that came out of the shimmer. There I get the impression this is someone who is frightened because he doesn't know what he is. He doesn't mm-hmm. know what he should be. He doesn't know his place in the universe. And that seems to frighten him. And that I can relate to. I can relate more to a surreal alien clone than to a real person. What does that say about me?
You're very much into sci-fi. That's what it says about you, to start with.
Possibly.
No, I mean, it's an open secret. You have much more access to movies like Ex Machina and Annihilation. You liked Ex Machina much, much more than I did. Annihilation is an exception because we both liked it a whole lot. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Annihilation, I think there's also an element there where it's not just a science fiction film. It's a science fiction film, it's also a philosophical film, and mm-hmm. it's also a horror film, and I get the impression that probably if you're given a choice between a horror movie, if it sounds interesting, and a sci-fi movie, you will pick the horror movie more than the sci-fi movie, right?
I think so. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Although the alligator and the bear in the movie, they're both not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't need such scenes in the book in order for me to enjoy the text mm-hmm. at all. There's much more that you can latch on to and think about and sort of build up your own version of the characters,
mm-hmm.
especially by the Natalie Portman biologist character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say that the alligator I can take or leave, but the bear is probably one of my favorite images
mm-hmm.
and concepts in recent sci-fi or horror.
Yeah, it's very interesting but highly creepy. Just imagine.
Exactly. I think it's really, I mean, the design is already effective, but the design could have that in any monster movie. But the way that basically, when it comes back, you first hear the voice of the last thing it's killed. So it mm-hmm. basically echoes its victims because its yep. victims in their moment of death become part of it. That is something I find extremely eerie and creepy.
Yeah, yeah. The DNA of a bear crossed with the DNA of a parrot, probably. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, it's even more metaphysical than that. It's just, you know, it consumed parts of its victims and its victims become it. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, it kind of becomes this collective bag of the people it's killed.
Yeah, it's... Oh, man.
But yeah, parrots are also scary, of course.
Of course, yes. Especially parrots from the Area X.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, you've said that you went that much into Ex Machina. Which one is your favorite Alex Garland film of the one he's done? I mean, whether he's written them or directed them.
Never Let Me Go. I think it's a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You think these children are orphans? For a very long time, it's presented as if they were orphans. Their mm-hmm. life circumstances are just, you know, there are no parents, there are no legal guardians. They're just in that wonderful home where they sort of sleep in a dorm, all of them together, play their records. I can absolutely see how Alex Garland was fascinated by that subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the least sci-fi he has ever done, mm-hmm. Alex Garland.
Absolutely.
Never Let Me Go.
I mean, I don't know, The Beach, does The Beach have anything sci-fi in it? I mean, I'm still convinced that Tilda Swinton is part alien, but in a good way.
The Beach does have... the Robert Carlyle character turns up more than once after he dies on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Other supernatural moments? No, I don't remember any others. But it's been a while since I've seen it, the movie, or read the book, anyway. Anything else is just a remote adventure with beaches and sand and fields of drugs later, something else. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I have to say that to some extent, I would probably say that the first two-thirds of Sunshine are my favorite Alex Garland movie, but mm-hmm. that's kind of outweighed by the last third, which has some massive problems. It's got a beautiful final yeah. scene, and I would say that I would still recommend Sunshine, but I would tell people, okay, once you get to the two-third mark, I don't know, stop your ears and just look at the nice pictures.
Fast forward.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's quite nice because I don't know if you remember the end credits of Sunshine actually show you the film in fast forward, kind of, with, you know, without the dialogues, just music and the images. It's almost like, you know, if you did fall asleep, this is the entire film.
I don't remember. I don't remember that. That's really quite something.
It's really weird, but it's kind of nice.
Yeah. All right. I have to watch it again.
But yeah,
yeah.
At the two-third point, stop your ears.
I'll heed that advice, thanks.
It's like Odysseus right. and the sirens.
In space. In space, nobody can hear the sirens.
Exactly.
Okay. this has been great fun. Another sci-fi adventure for you who like sci-fi and for me who is sort of skeptical about it. Fantastic. This has been great. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you. Aren't you glad we didn't talk about Thor Ragnarok?
Well, there are things to say about Thor Ragnarok, aren't there?
Yeah.
Yeah. This has been episode 8 of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I hope you've enjoyed our slightly incoherent ramblings. Maybe we are infected by the shimmer in a way. We don't know.
Help me.
Yes. Thanks to you, Matt. Thanks a lot to our listeners. And let's catch up in a month's time.
Absolutely.
See you later.
See you around.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Stand by the stairway, you'll see something certain to tell you. Confusion has its cause. Love isn't lying, it's loose in a lady who lingers, saying she is love.